Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique, studio plus suite awaits with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your studio plus suite today at livepreferred.com.
Welcome back to The Bulwark Goes to Hollywood. My name is Sonny Bunch. I'm culture editor at The Bulwark. And I'm very pleased to be joined today by Nick Desemlian, who is the author of The Last Action Heroes. It's a great new book about the movie stars of the 1980s. We all grew up watching and loving in theaters, and is also the editor at Empire Magazine, a great magazine over in England. I love having the Brits on because they class up the joint with their accents. Thank you for being on the show today, Nick. I really appreciate it.
Thanks for having me on. I'm actually American as well. I got dual nationality, so bring in the British accent, but do have an American passport as well.
Oh, look at that. Great. The best of both worlds. So here we are to talk about The Last Action Heroes, which I've read and quite enjoyed. Loved it a lot. Again, there's a certain nostalgia factor here for me and many of the other folks who are reading this. But it's super interesting. And one thing I want to key on just right at the beginning is something that I also picked up in Quentin Tarantino's book, Cinema Speculation. He writes about in his book how Rocky kind of reinvigorated the nation. It was after a bunch of years of kind of like dark, downbeat stuff. You have Rocky come out and it's just kind of upbeat and fun. And even if Rocky doesn't win at the end, it still, you know, gives people something to cheer for. That's something you key on as well. How did Rocky help inaugurate the shift that we see in this book from kind of downbeat, you know, decline sort of movies to like, hey, rah, rah, action, big heroes, big biceps, big guns?
Yeah, it's interesting because you look at the films that Rocky was up against at the Oscars and they're all that kind of 70s downbeat. It's like Network, Taxi Driver, Carrie, you know, none of these are like particularly cheerful movies that will have you punch in the air like Rocky does. So I think it's really interesting. Like when I was figuring out where to start the book, Rocky, even though it's not like a traditional action movie, doesn't pick up a gun, unlike most of the movies I cover in the book, but it just felt like the start of the one man army genre in a way, even though he's a boxer, because it just has that 80s feeling of optimism, even though it out of the Rocky films, it's the one that doesn't have the conventionally happy ending. He doesn't like win the fight, but he does win in a way. But yeah, the 70s was obviously like a really difficult, turbulent time in America and a lot of bad things going on and a lot of uncertainty. And you saw that reflected in the movies, obviously, with a lot of heroes who were very compromised and usually end up losing. And then Rocky came along and bucked that trend and people really responded to it. So it is the kind of the marking point between the two things. It feels, you know, half like a 70s movie and half like an 80s movie, if that's not oversimplifying it.
Yeah, no, totally. I mean, I think you can create a pretty clear dividing line right there. And right at the beginning, right when Rocky hits, at the start there, you have the and you write about this in the book, you see the start of the competition between Sylvester Stallone and Schwarzenegger. They're seated at the, I believe, the same table at the Emmys, was it?
Or Golden Globes.
Golden Globes. Yeah. The Golden Globes. Yeah, the Golden Globes, where they're kind of eyeballing each other. What was happening there?
Well, it's kind of an amazing story. So Stallone was up for an award. He didn't get the Oscar. He wasn't happy about it, according to the people I spoke to. And he didn't get the Golden Globe. Rocky, you know, didn't do as well as he hoped that night. And then he had this Austrian guy, Arnold Schwarzenegger, who had just started and he was up for a Best Newcomer, which he won. And Stallone took ill to that. And apparently, according to Stallone, I haven't been able to find anywhere else to kind of verify it outside of that table of people, but apparently he picked up a flower pot and lobbed it at Schwarzenegger's head. And the mind boggles. I wish there was video of that happening because that sounds absolutely insane. But apparently that was their first ever encounter.
Yeah. I mean, it's funny. We have days-long conversations about whether or not Harry Styles spit on Chris Pine, and yet here we have, you know, the two great action stars of the 1980s chucking pottery at each other. It's wonderful. Let's talk. All right, so we have the Rocky end of things. He comes in or Stallone comes in with Rocky, and then shifts to Rambo, which we can talk about here in a second. But then you do have the Schwarzenegger side of things, who is also doing some interesting stuff here. And you know, the first, I mean, obviously there's the Hercules movie, there's Pumping Iron, but the first real big hit, the thing that kind of puts him on the radar for lots of folks, is Conan the Barbarian. He almost got fired from that movie, did he not?
Well, Dino De Laurentiis was the producer, and apparently their first encounter went very badly. There was no flower pots thrown at anyone, but apparently Schwarzenegger came in and made fun of his desk, and Dino De Laurentiis was quite a little guy, and Schwarzenegger said something like, you know, it's such a tiny guy like you got such a huge desk, and apparently the meeting lasted under a minute. So Dino De Laurentiis did not want Schwarzenegger to play Conan, but, you know, and they did look at other people. Christopher Lambert, apparently they had various meetings with, which is interesting. The Highlander himself, but no, they eventually he did end up in the movie, obviously, and there was something about it that worked. There were a lot of movies that didn't work for Schwarzenegger. You know, Hercules in New York, which was his first ever movie, is absolutely abysmal. I think everyone involved would tell you that. But there was something about Conan, and it's so pumped up and ludicrous in the mythology, and it kind of takes itself seriously in a way. And yeah, that was the movie that connected for him. But it took a long time for Schwarzenegger and for Stallone for that big breakthrough movie to come along.
It really is the perfect melding of star material and director. I mean, you know, John Milius, of course, is well known as a colorful personality. He's got a big, you know, sense of himself and of the stuff he's working on here. But it really is it is the idea of this 1980s action star kind of boiled down to its essence, right? Big guy, big muscles, big sword, big body count. Like that is basically the template for everything going forward. Yeah.
Big snakes as well. Yeah, everything in that movie is just excessive. And it hadn't got to the, you know, it obviously with Arnold, it got to a point where everything was a bit tongue-in-cheek with him. But it's interesting watching Conan because it does take itself very seriously. You know, John Milius, when I interviewed him for the book, he called himself a real-life barbarian. You know, he was taking this subject matter very, very seriously. There was nothing kind of campy or comic booky for him about it. So yeah, it's and it remains completely iconic, and it's a very strange film, and they couldn't replicate it with the second one. The Conan the Destroyer leaned much more into the kind of the campy direction. It doesn't work. There's something about the barbarian that just it believes in. It's a film that believes in what it's doing, and yeah, it's still pretty potent.
Yeah, it holds up, I think. I mean, it's dated in the ways that any movie with special effects from the early 1980s is going to be dated, but it does have that real vibrant, you know, sense of life to it. Can we talk a little bit about sources? I was just curious because I as I said, I read the whole book, but I did not read the sourcing at the end, which is always a mistake. So can we talk about who you talked to for the book and who of the like main the main character, so to speak, who you were able to get on the phone or on Zoom and chat with?
Yeah, well, some of the material is from over the years at Empire, people I've been fortunate enough to meet. Actually, 7 out of the 8 main characters I've been able to spend time with and interview. Stallone is the only one I haven't actually spoken to, but Schwarzenegger I've spoken to a few times. Chuck Norris, I got to fly to Austin and spend a very strange weekend with him a bunch of years back. Jackie Chan went out and met him in Shanghai for 2 days through Empire. And then Seagal and Van Damme I've spoken to on the phone. So yeah, and then for the book, I spoke to a lot of you know, directors, writers, actors, people. You know, I've spoken to James Cameron, John Milius, Paul Verhoeven, Rennie Harlin, John McTiernan, and all those kind of people who were there back in the heyday making these movies. Got to speak to Oliver Stone also, who wrote the original script for Conan and hated the end result. So it's quite interesting, kind of hearing him, you know, having a pop at the film. He was not a fan of Dino De Laurentiis either.
Well, it's interesting to hear some of the folks talk about what the final product looked like compared to what they thought they were working on. Oliver Stone, you mentioned. Also, James Cameron, I think, did a draft on, was that Rambo 2?
First Blood Part 2.
What happened there? What was that story? Because James Cameron, in the news right now, the Titanic expert, of course, he is, of course, also a very well-known screenwriter in his own right. So what happened there with Rocky 2? I'm sorry, Rambo 2. Rambo 2, not Rocky.
Well, he was hired to do the script. You know, obviously, there's a legendary story about him meeting Arnold for the first time for Terminator at Shatsi, I believe, is the restaurant. And they got on immediately and they clicked and obviously had this amazing collaboration together. He had a similar lunch with Stallone, but it's fair to say the two of them did not click. And Stallone, it seems to be it's a recurring theme in all the directors and writers I spoke to who worked with Stallone, where he would come into a project and he would just basically take over and wanted control of everything. And so, you know, Cameron wrote the script. It's online. You can read it. It's pretty good, actually. But Stallone, came in and kind of muscled him out the way. And Cameron has talked about that not being a good collaboration for him. And he did not like the final film. He thought it was way too violent, way too many, just gun porn, basically. It's an interesting thought, like what would the Terminator have been like if Stallone had ended up in that? But it was not to be. They did not get on.
Yeah. One of the kind of running undercurrents of the book, I wouldn't say it's necessarily a theme exactly, but it is a running undercurrent of the story here, is the collision of this big screen identity persona that Hollywood is putting out there. And also the kind of co-opting of that by Reagan, right? The 1980s Republicans, you've got this, Reagan is hanging out with Sylvester Stallone, friendly with Arnold Schwarzenegger. And there is this kind of sense of like Reagan's America is Rambo's America, is the America of Predator and Commando and that sort of stuff. How did you, when you were writing the book, kind of want to balance those ideas? Because again, it's not, there's a version of this book that is a kind of haranguing, like, can you believe how this happened? That is not this book. And I kind of appreciate that, frankly.
Well, yeah, it's a case of striking a balance because it's some of these films are great and they're masterpieces and they're worth rewatching, and some of them are absolute trash and have, frankly, very dubious politics. And so it's a case of threading your way through that material. And hopefully I tried to do that with the book. You know, I didn't want to write a book that was dismissing all of these films as trash. There's a good chance that they made the world a more violent place by glorifying guns and all the rest of it. But there's also a lot of these films are really ingenious and well written and worth celebrating. So definitely the politics is a really interesting thing, and I wanted each chapter to do a slightly different thing. And there's a chapter around the middle of the book which kind of deals with the Reagan stuff, which I think is fascinating. Like you said, his friendship with Stallone is so strange. Like, can't think of another example where you had this A-list Hollywood star being that chummy with the American president, and Reagan calling Stallone while he was making Rambo 3, and Stallone is wearing his Rambo outfit and he's got Reagan calling him, and they're talking about foreign policy while Rambo is like mowing down Russians. And yeah, like you said, a lot of these films feel like American foreign policy, or like the fantasy of what American policy should be, or even like what America wanted to do but couldn't quite do. Parachuting in these muscly guys with huge guns and making things right. And you see that especially in the Chuck Norris movies. I think he went the furthest with that. Going to Vietnam and winning, but certainly with Stallone as well. I think these kind of right-leaning, more conservative stars were definitely looking at the headlines and thinking, right, what can we make right on screen? And it's kind of funny looking at like Stallone in the late 80s trying to figure out where he's going to set the next Rambo film, and just literally looking at all the war zones and thinking like, where can I go and just like kill everyone.
Yeah. You mentioned Chuck Norris, and I want to talk about him a little bit more too. But in the context of this discussion about, you know, how it reflects the world, there's this really interesting anecdote that I'd actually never heard before. I'm surprised I've never heard this about Invasion USA being a huge hit in Romania. That, you know, when when Ceausescu was overthrown, the folks there were, you know, inspired, at least in part, or I guess you could say, Invasion USA. And like, you could still go there. There's posters on the walls, that sort of thing. I mean, that's pretty wild. That is not something I expected necessarily.
I did not know that either. I interviewed, I believe it was James Bruner, the writer of Invasion USA, who worked with Chuck Norris a lot. And there's a lot of crossover between, you know, the writers and directors working with these stars. Lots of them worked with various ones of them. But yeah, he talked about how that movie, which is kind of, you know, by modern standards, just xenophobic and trashy and, ludicrously one-dimensional. That's the for anyone who hasn't seen it, that's the Chuck Norris film where, you know, a load of foreigners come in and basically take over an American city. And it's just utterly ridiculous. Apparently inspired freedom fighters in Romania. And they still, there's a cult around these Chuck Norris films where they're inspiring people to fight for democracy. So it's not as simple, I don't think, as saying this film is trash and this film is worthless. Like, there's a lot of complexity to how the effects and influence these films have had around the world. So I tried to kind of address that in the book, in the way I came at things.
Norris is an interesting guy too, because it feels like there's a real split between your Schwarzenegger, Stallone, even Bruce Willis to a certain extent types, though he is obviously on the smaller side of just physically smaller side of things. But your Chuck Norris's, Jackie Chan's, Steven Seagal's, Jean-Claude Van Damme's, who are like actual martial artists who, you know, Chuck Norris fighting with Bruce Lee in his movies and holding his own, like a real black belt award winning fighter. When you were looking back at these movies and watching them for the book, what were the splits that you saw between the two types of actors and the types of movies they made?
Like you said, it's interesting because, Arnold came from the world of bodybuilding. So he was into that. You know, it's a competitive sport and karate is a competitive sport. So you had these guys who came from the sports world and then they were trying to fit their skills into a narrative movie. And it's quite funny when you watch a bunch of Chuck Norris films because they're quite clunky in the way that they try and fit the karate in. So there's one of his movies, the name has escaped me right the second, but one of his movies, he plays a karate teacher, I think in Chicago, who the police basically bring in because they're trying to stop a serial killer and they need a karate guy, which makes absolutely no sense. Like, just get someone with a gun. That's going to be more effective. But they build entire plots around the fact he's good at karate. The divide is really the megastars, the Stallone and the Schwarzenegger, and like you said, Bruce Willis when he comes in. And then there's this second tier of people who, you know, people now do not take as seriously to different degrees. Certainly Chuck Norris is probably taken the least seriously out of all eight. You know, he's become a bit of a laughing stock. Mm-hmm. But I think, you know, he's actually one of the nicest out of these bunch of people. Like, it's interesting on screen, he's this invincible killing machine, but he is actually a lovely person and everyone has good stories about him. To this day, that's the only interview I've done where the person I'm interviewing has asked to pray before we start. I was like, that was my Chuck Norris experience. But he's this very genial guy who was selling pairs of action jeans.
I've heard bad stories about lots of people, including most of the people in this book, but Chuck Norris is in fact the one guy I've never heard somebody have a crossword about. Just he is respected by everybody and shows respect to everybody as far as I can tell. And there's actually a great anecdote in your book about when the time somebody tried to pick a fight with him at a bar, didn't realize who he was. Could you just relay that anecdote for us? I think folks would like to hear it.
Yeah, that was during the shooting of Walker, Texas Ranger. And Chuck Norris was sitting in a bar. This guy comes over and tells him to move. And he gets up and moves, and then a bunch of the people working on the show come in and go over, and the penny drops, and the guy realizes he's just told Chuck Norris to move, and he goes over and apologizes to him, and asks why Chuck Norris didn't beat the crap out of him, and is just amazed that this guy who's just famed for taking no shit from anyone is actually in real life just like, yep, sure. He's kind of a Ned Flanders-ish kind of guy in his niceness. I mean, obviously, Chuck Norris's politics not everyone agrees with, and he's said some questionable things in recent years. But I think definitely on a personal level, he seems like the absolute antithesis of his screen image. Whereas you have someone like Steven Seagal, who is just by all accounts, there's no difference between what you see on the screen and how he acts in real life, and
Well, I was going to say, there are a lot of people who are annoyed in your book with Sylvester Stallone, as you mentioned, who kind of comes in and takes over a project. But I would say that of the sort of main characters in your book, Steven Seagal is the only one who is kind of universally loathed by folks. He does not seem to have many friends in this industry or this book.
No, well, I did speak to a guy called Conrad Parmacento, who is a fan. He has worked with Chuck Norris a lot. He coordinates Chuck Norris's, Steven Seagal's fight sequences, or certainly did in the early movies. And he was pro Seagal, but otherwise, it's very difficult. And I wasn't going in with an agenda of like, tell me all the stories of when Steven Seagal was terrible. It's just literally no one had anything good to say. Apparently, when he worked with Pam Grier on one of his first films, she was going through a cancer scare in hospital, and apparently he was one of the few people who came and visited her, and she talked about that at the time. So that's the only real example of any time I can find evidence of him doing anything nice for anyone. But otherwise, he certainly seems like quite a toxic human being by all accounts.
It's interesting just because he's also the one who kind of comes across as so like spiritualism was part of his whole gag. He was like, I'm the Zen fighting Buddhist master, whatever. And it's interesting to kind of hear these folks talk about him and what he's like in his, what he's like in real life. Jean-Claude Van Damme, on the other hand, people seem, I'm sure he has his own issues. He's had a few marriages, whatever. But he does, he comes off pretty well, I think. Folks seem to mostly at least be amused by him, if not, not the biggest fans in the world.
Yeah, he's a peculiar man. I mean, they all are quite peculiar to different degrees. Van Damme is maybe the most peculiar out of the eight people in the book, and just constantly saying bizarre things, and very entertaining to interview because you have no idea what is going to come out of his mouth. And, when I interviewed him, he let slip that he'd had a mini affair with Kylie Minogue while making Street Fighter that then kind of became a big story because no one had known that. And, claimed to only sleep 2 hours a night or something like that, and just constantly saying absolutely bizarre things. But has that kind of genial nature and is very affable, and I think that kind of undercuts the machismo of these movies, all the testosterone. And Schwarzenegger very wisely brought comedy into his films quite early on, because when you don't, it's the films that are completely self-serious out of this genre that haven't aged that well. And I was watching Cobra the other night. It has its supporters, Stallone's Cobra, but it takes itself so seriously that it's actually hilarious to watch because it's just so ludicrous.
Well, I saw you tweeted out an amazing montage yesterday, the day before, that was for some reason there are robots involved. I've seen Cobra. I was like, God, what is that? What are the robots doing?
This was Stallone's robot phase, I guess, because we had Rocky IV. I guess in the mid 80s it was all about robots. Like, he was into robots. I've not heard him talk about robots, but there's the scene in Cobra where he and his cop partner are going around and looking for clues in this rather strange montage, and then it just cuts to Bridget Nielsen like sort of writhing around with robots in a kind of fashion photo shoot. It's very, very peculiar, but there's no sense that it's intended to be funny, which is what makes it hilarious. But yeah, Van Damme, his movies are fun in a way that Seagal's aren't. So I think they he's made a lot of bad films, but I'm a huge fan of like Hard Target, Sudden Death. You know, these are just kind of deliberately ludicrous films that are fun to watch.
Yeah. Yeah. When you were, I have one complaint about this book, and I'm very sorry to do this, but I have to bring it up here. My one complaint is that it's too short. It needs to be longer. I wanted more on each of these guys. Were you worried, when you were writing it, just like, well, I want to do, you know, 50 more pages on Jackie Chan, or like, I want to cover more of Bruce Willis's career here, but he kind of like run out of time, because he comes into this pretty late in the story of these guys. I mean, I'm a little tongue in cheek here, but that was my one feeling when I was done reading it. I was like, I want more. I need more. Do you have a sequel? Is there you know?
Yeah, well, I could have definitely written more. You know, there are a ton of movies that I wish I could had got into. Cobra being one. I think you could write a whole book on Cobra. Hudson Hawk, you know, there were a whole bunch. And Bruce Willis, definitely, I could have gone into a bit more. It came in at 100,000 words, so it's actually slightly longer than my previous book. But yeah, as you say, there's so much to pack in with these guys. But I guess I just wanted to keep it quite brisk and breezy and not kind of outstay its welcome. And I kind of tried to, you know, make it feel kind of in the spirit of those 80s action movies that move at a clip and they're not bloated and 2 hours long like a lot of action movies are these days. You know, I'd love the John Wick films, but the last one was so long that I was kind of checking my watch a little bit. And there's something about the movies of this period that none of them outstay their welcome, really. Like they all kind of move and then just get out of there. So I hear your point. There could have been a lot more. I mean, you could write a 5-volume book series on Steven Seagal. I'd read it. There's many stories, I'm sure, yet to be unearthed. But I wanted to kind of bring it in before people got bored. That was
Last Action Heroes 2. That's all I'm saying. I'm just gonna Last Action Heroes. I'm trying to do the James Cameron dollar sign thing. I've already got an S in it, though. I can't do it
this time. This time they're the last ones. We promise.
The one guy we haven't really talked very much about, who again is a main character here, is Jackie Chan. Now, Jackie Chan, again, has a slightly different sensibility from some of these other guys in that he is almost a Buster Keaton-like figure. He is a guy who's doing his own stunts, and it's very frequently very funny. And, you know, kind of he sells the action himself, but he does it in a way that is, again, funny and comic in a way that Arnold's one-liners are comic, but he does it with his body. What was the view of Chan by these guys who were in America and were either aware or unaware of his work? I mean, I'm really curious how the rest of them and folks in America at the time saw him, because again, this is, you know, we're talking about the 80s here, and I feel like he doesn't really burst onto the scene in America until Rumble in the Bronx, right? And that's 93, 94, something like that.
Yeah, the early 90s. He was really only known in America at, you know, before then by people who really knew their stuff. Tarantino was championing him way before anyone else. And actually, out of these other 7 action stars, it was Stallone who you know, as I get into in the book, was the one who really was into Jackie Chan's stuff and got in touch with Jackie Chan. And Jackie Chan was like, is this the Stallone? Like, he invited him to America. So, you know, Jackie Chan was actually quite a late addition to the book. He wasn't originally going to be in it because he's slightly different to the others. He's not in America. He's not in Hollywood. He's doing his own thing in China. But I'm really glad that he came into it, because I think he gives you something different. And he's obviously an action titan. And the structure is kind of his attempt to break into Hollywood. He has 2 attempts that are unsuccessful. And then Stallone kind of facilitates that 3rd one, which does work out. And obviously, he then does the Rush Hour films and becomes a huge Hollywood star. But he really took him a long time to get there. But like you said, he's different to the others. He's this kind of acrobat. He's a roly-poly acrobat. He's not afraid to make himself look ridiculous. There's a lot of very broad, silly comedy. I recently watched the first 3 police stories at the Prince Charles Cinema here in London. And an amazing night. But I'd forgotten, I always forget, you remember the big stunts, but you forget how much slapstick and the first Police Story movie, there's all this extended comedy with his girlfriend and, you know, he's getting whacked on the head. And it is like watching a Buster Keaton movie. And you don't get that with any of these other guys. And then you add the fact that he was doing stuff for real and there was something completely unique about him. But yeah, it took America a long time to kind of realize how great he was.
That was everything I wanted to ask about the book. Can we talk about Empire just for a minute? Because I am, as a lover of magazines, I love Empire and just like the idea of, you know, big glossy pop culture magazines. How do you, when you're sitting down to plan out a magazine, first off, how far ahead are you looking? Are you doing these 3-4 months in advance? What's the lead time on a new issue of Empire?
Well, more than that, just before I came on this call, we were having a chat about something at the end of next year. So it's, you have to be really far ahead because obviously these movies are, you know, things are being shot now that you're not going to see for right. 1, 2, maybe even 3 years. So you're kind of having conversations about, you know, Avatar 4 before you've seen Avatar 3. But we try and, you know, obviously every issue is kind of invented on the fly, but definitely you're having conversations about covers, about interviews, about what you can pull off. And definitely found that the longer ahead you plan, the better. You know, we managed to get a big Indiana Jones exclusive at the end of last year, which I was, as you know, Raiders is my favorite film. So I was very happy that we got to, you know, put the cover out before the trailer had even come out. So it was literally the first looks at the film, but that was like a long time in the planning. And you need to start those conversations super early. So yeah, it's a mixture of forward planning and then just tearing your hair out and things going wrong. And it's always a mad scramble to press week. But yeah, we're still hanging in there. It's, you know, print magazines are becoming, you know, a dying breed. So we're doing our best to keep it going. And it's still exciting.
It's tough. It's as a refugee from the world of print magazines, I am always happy to see one thriving and succeeding in this world. All right, so that was pretty much everything I wanted to ask. I always like to close these interviews by asking if there's anything I should ask. Like, what do you think folks should know about your book, about the state of action movies in the 1980s or today, or you know, Empire magazine? Anything you think folks should know about?
Huh. That's a fantastic question, and I feel completely stumped by it. No, I just, in terms of Empire, I would just ask that people check it out. I think sometimes people forget there are print magazines that are still going. You know, there's so much noise these days that we're competing with podcasts and websites and, you know, social media and everything there is. But, you know, please do check it out. It's available in the States, available as a digital edition, and we'd love people to check it out. In terms of the book, no, not really. I don't know. That's a really good question. I don't know. What do I think people should know about it? I think people should read it. That's what I think.
That's fair. That's always a good suggestion with a book. Read it.
And then watch Cobra.
And then go watch Cobra. Is Cobra on? Cobra's got to be on Netflix or somewhere. It's got to be available on streaming somewhere. Well, Nick, thank you very much for being on the show. I really appreciate it. Again, the name of the book is The Last Action Heroes. You just search for it on Amazon. You'll find it. Barnes & Noble. It's Google it, whatever. It's easy to get. And I will say that one of the reasons we're having this call is because a friend of mine read it and was like, you got to get him on the show. I was like, well, I've already read it. It's good. And I, all right, fine, I'll do it. So thank you for being on the show. You'll make him very happy.
Well, thank you to you and to your friend. I really appreciate it. And if anyone out there is reading it, I would love to know what films it inspires you to watch, because there's a lot. Someone made a Letterboxd list of all the films mentioned in the book, and it's quite an eclectic bunch. Okay. There are some very bad films mentioned, some good ones as well. But if anyone ends up watching, you know, Chuck Norris's Code of Silence or anything more obscure that I write about, I'd love to hear it.
All right. Nick, thanks for being on the show. My name, again, is Sonny Bunch. I'm culture editor at The Bulwark, and I will be back next week with another episode. We'll see you guys then.
Step Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique, studio plus suite awaits with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your studio plus suite today at livepreferred.com.
You can't rely on blind faith to get the pregnancy support you deserve. Ritual's Essential Prenatal Multivitamin is the only leading prenatal backed by its own human clinical trial. Essential Prenatal is proven to deliver key nutrients, including folate, biotin, and vitamin D during pregnancy. Get 25% off when you visit ritual.com/clinical. These statements have not been evaluated by the Food and Drug Administration. This product is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease.
Sally from finance loves fly fishing. She used to spend her weekend surrounded by receipts. Then she switched her company to Ramp. Now, spend is all under control, all in one place. Her team submits their expenses with a text, and she can close the books without all the busy work. So Sally's weekends are all her own, surrounded by fish, not receipts. Switch your business to ramp.com and love finance again.